Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, March 6th, 2012, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts Lavendar and Sierra. Our featured guest this evening is Sheila Keen Lund. Sheila had two near-death experiences before she was a teenager, which fueled her passion to discover answers to the questions, who am I, why am I here, and where am I in the universe? She delved into meditation and the study of metaphysics, and she felt drawn to stories about aliens and wondered how these related to the gods who founded civilization as described on clay tablets by the ancient Sumerians. During a period of intense research, inquiry, and contemplation, she found the Urantia book, an unparalleled ethical revelation transmitted to our world and published in the mid-20th century. Attempting to disprove its claims and concepts, Sheila wrote, "Heaven is not the last stop," weaving a lively narrative from insights on philosophy, history, culture, science, and religion with the advanced concepts and insights presented in the Urantia book. Excuse me. The result is that "Heaven is not the last stop" extends the horizons of current understanding about our place in the universe and is a compelling invitation to take our next step as evolving global citizens by becoming conscious members of the greater cosmic family. Her website is heavenisnotthelaststop.com. Sheila has traveled worldwide leading classes and workshops on the practical application of the extraordinary principles in her book. Now, she'll be joining us right after this first segment, because at the top of the show, we're presenting the second segment of a new series called High Strangeness with Anastasia, Part 2. Anastasia is one of our Starseed Hotline team. She'll be telling her own story of contact with ETs and how she grew because of it. It's intended to help others deal with the confusion that can follow an encounter with high strangeness. Each week we'll give you another short segment as the story unfolds, so make sure you hear them in sequence. We want to thank Sahar this evening for hosting the switchboard, and if you have questions for Sheila, please call in on 917-889-8292 and then press 1 so we know you'd like to come on the air. And if you like our show, remember to click follow on our show page and tell a friend about us. For our new listeners, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation, and we also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. And we'll get started with the second segment of High Strangeness in just a moment and then introduce Sheila Keen Lund. But first, I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. Our Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings in your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone consultation. You can find out if you have star markings and how they determine your natural state and rites of passage. We now offer a Stage 4 support service with Sierra for contactees and abductees, so check out Sierra's World on our main site. And don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing at least a week beforehand. Your manifestational ability is amplified 1,000-fold during those 10 hours, so please make the most of it. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening. Lavendar here. This is going to be a great show. So is Sierra with us?
Yes.
I sure am.
Good. I hope your arm is better.
Oh, it is, and thank you out there to all the listeners who sent me good thoughts and prayers over this last week. I have really healed tremendously and quickly or past what the doctor said I would. So thank you to all of you who are sending healing thoughts my way.
Okay, good, good. I'm so glad to hear that, Sarah. So, Ariel, you can go ahead and start our high strangeness report.
Okay, this is High Strangeness with Anastasia, Part 2.
This is Lavender having an interview today with our dear friend Anastasia, who is on our website and one of our counselors. And I would like to welcome you now to Part 2, Anastasia, of something that we call High Strangeness with Anastasia. Welcome.
Hi, Lavendar. Hello, everybody. It's great to be with you tonight.
I know. It was.
Thanks for having me on.
It was really, really great hearing the things that happened to you in Part 1. And so why don't we just pick up where we left off from last week. And
okay.
I think you were talking about when you were 14 and 16 and how that you had had these experiences with ETs or bright lights or angels or all the above. And
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I had asked you, you know, why you had not really wanted to talk about these things. And you had said something so profound that I wanted to share it with our audience. And that is, sometimes when we have these high strangeness events, we put a screen up around or we block them because to have to deal with them is too hard.
Mm-hmm,
and I think that's very valid. There are so many
mm-hmm.
times that I can look back on my life and know when I did that. And I did
mm-hmm.
it for my sanity.
Yes, absolutely.
You
and
do
I'm
it for
sure a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, you
mm-hmm.
do it for self-preservation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because no matter what, as we transition to higher dimensions and experience the reality that is beyond the view of our physical eyes, and then have to be in the 3D world and where people are sleeping and clueless, not to be disrespectful, but that's where it's at, the mind can't compute. The personality has got to find a way to keep balance.
That's right.
Which is one good reason why I think that we really don't remember our past lives. People bemoan that to me now and then. Why can't I remember my past lives? And I have to laugh. You'd be a raving lunatic.
Oh, not only a raving lunatic, but you would get into judgment about who needs to be killed next.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Which
mean,
is hard enough to stay out of now.
It's like, oh, they killed me. Well, I'm going to go kill them. I mean, that's
yeah.
one of the reasons we can't remember. I mean, that
absolutely.
Is really a safeguard.
It is absolutely a safeguard. So anyway, that's all very funny. You know, if you can't laugh, then
yeah,
it's really
true.
Important to be... Yeah, we have to be able to keep our sense of humor. And it really, a lot of it is very amusing and delightful, I might add.
And
to our starseed... Huh?
Yeah, and I wanted to add that, you know, sometimes when, say, you're with your mate and you've been with him another lifetime, there will be a bleed-through from another lifetime, and all of a sudden you'll start acting up, and you don't know why you're acting up. It's because
absolutely.
Your higher mind has tapped into the past life that you're trying to balance out, and it screws with you.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the biggest things, if you try to think about this logically and linearly, you're just sunk. But when you kind of let go and don't try to rationalize it, the concept, the very true fact that there is no past, present, or future, it's all in the now, is just the most delicious thing because all of this is occurring simultaneously. And I think in one of your broadcasts, Lavendar, you were talking about, I do believe it was you, talking about in any given moment, let's say you're sitting in your living room or I'm sitting at my desk, and at this point maybe there is a Native American running through the room from because as the time zones run together, I mean, all things are happening simultaneously is what I'm trying to say. So we can tap into different times, dimensions, and even parallel realities at any given moment, and that can be very confusing, and sometimes we can't sort out where it's coming from, but all of those things are possibilities. And as we expand in consciousness, and with a lot of the people that I counsel who have experiences of high strangeness, one of the challenges is, if it's called for, to figure out where this is coming from and why. And sometimes it's just simply about not trying to figure it out, but saying, wow, that's interesting, that's cool, and setting it aside and not fixating on it. Because these things can come so rapidly once, you know, if we stop and think about it or stay too long on one point, we can develop blocks and then we don't grow. So when we are experiencing these things and we don't have answers, sometimes the fixation on the question why is not the place to be, but just simply to say, wow, that is awesome, and I don't know what it means, but let's get on with it, and more things will open up. So that's something to be mindful of as we...
I have a saying, understanding is not a prerequisite for a happening.
Absolutely. Isn't that
is
truth,
kind of
though?
My definition of high strangeness.
Absolutely. That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. That's right on.
Well, let's pick up where we left off. You were 14 and 16. You were living in Mount Shasta. You had had
yes.
an incredible encounter when you were 3. You had another one when you were 5. Now, the 5 one was where the veil went down, and you got very
yes.
sad because you couldn't remember. So
mm-hmm.
let's start where we left off last week, 14 and 16. You know, at that period of time, you were probably developing into a fine, beautiful young woman that was, you know, starting to attract the male sex. So did the men that were in your arena, did they see you as different, or was there something about
very,
you that started
very,
attracting men?
Sure, very. And, you know, that is probably a long history of, I think it's very similar to yours, Lavendar. And those that have listened to the program know your story, so I'll let that rest there. But yes, and I was perceived as different, which was so painful in adolescent years. That was a real challenge to learn to accept self and to be oneself in the face of being seen and perceived as different. And I went through a phase where I didn't want to be different. And I think most listeners can identify with that. So I began to attend churches and search for spirituality in the conventional way, which the reason this has bearing on this program tonight is that after many long years of giving myself fully to that and figuring out that that was not a reflection of cosmic truth in the biggest sense, and then coming out of that later on, experiencing spiritual crisis when one really realizes that what you've been told is not authentic. That is a thing that a lot of starseed have experienced or have gone through or are going through. And many people that aren't starseed that are in transition between the old reality or the old paradigm of belief and expanding their truths to something very different creates a tremendous difficulty to get out of the quicksand of programming and indoctrination that really represses the spirit and keeps people down. And so one of the specialties that I have in my work is to help people in their crossover from, let's say, conventional thinking to expanded consciousness. Because people do need a lot of times help in seeing that there's nothing wrong with them and that they're not being bad in order to, you know, to question and to move forward with their lives. So that's kind of a specialty that I have. But anyway, to get back to what we were talking about, nevertheless, even though I pursued a more traditional approach to spirituality for a short time, my clairvoyance continued to grow and expand. And it took on then in that context... for a short time, more religious type experiences, which was very, very confusing to me early on. It created a great deal of grief because, looking back now, of course, after many decades, I see that it was part of my growth and learning experience and that many, many people experience this. I learned how deception and consciousness or the focus of one's consciousness plays out in paranormal and high strangeness experiences. So that I was taught early on through all of this that not all things that we perceive or that present themselves to us in the terms of visionary experiences, religious experience, and so on, are really authentic, but rather serve as extensions of our consciousness in the moment. Does that make sense to you? Do you know what I'm talking
about?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And so, of course, I get many people that come to me that have had experiences, and I'm able to then do my best to try to weigh that with them as to what the purpose is and perhaps teach them a little patience that, well, some things we aren't meant to take quite so literally, but to, again, one of my favorite sayings is to just put that up on the shelf and let it reveal itself to you as whether it's authentic or based in truth or not. But anyway, that ran its course, of course, and I went through a spiritual crisis of belief and found my way back to my true authentic origins as a spiritual seeker, which was a tremendous time in my life, one of great opening. I became introduced to various metaphysical teachings. I was trained in the tradition of the Tibetan Foundation to be a channel. And for a number of years, decades actually, I was a deep trance channel after the fashion of Edgar Cayce and did thousands and thousands of readings like that for many clients all over the country.
Wow. Let me ask you about Mount Shasta. You had mentioned it in before. Don't you think that by you living at that area and being there and having the experiences that you did had a great bearing on everything that's happening for you now and in the future?
Oh, sure I do. I mean, these are energies that were implanted early on in life. And you bet. And I was...
You know, I have heard something about Mount Shasta. I don't know if it's true or not. Maybe you know. It says that the mountain itself is a sentient being, and that if you do not have the right intent, there's a road that if you take, that the car just reverses and goes down the mountain and won't let you go any further. Is that
well,
true?
That I've not taken that road. The mountain always allowed me access, but certainly there are stories. Exactly.
Have you heard that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I've not known of anyone that's happened to, because, you know, I just don't know of it. But certainly it is common. I mean, I've heard that.
Well, yeah, I've heard that through the years, and
I also have known. Like, excuse me for interrupting you. I've also known people to just go up there and get spooked. They just feel afraid and want off. You know, they just want to get down. So I do think that this is about energy compatibility and.
Yeah.
I think that the mountain is sentient, and I think if it wants you there, fine. You know, you're welcome, you're embraced, you're nurtured. If not, well, you'll just move right along. So,
And I,
like I said, I haven't been there for many, many years, and I know that there is now a New Age movement or a spiritual movement that's springing up there. And at the time that I lived there, there was no such thing. I mean, it was very traditional with its churches and so on, except for the IM Foundation that was in the town of Dunsmuir, which was very popular and which was established by the Ballards probably, I don't know, in the 50s. So that was about the only New Age activity in the area when I was a child growing up.
Again, understanding is not a prerequisite for a happening, because you were there as a small child. The energies were collecting. It was an observation point. I know that it's an intergalactic species station. I know that ships come in and out of there, and they were doing it then. They're doing it now. You're still connected to Mount Shasta. There's just no doubt in my mind about that.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to end this segment by saying that those of you who are not acquainted with Anastasia and her work, and if you would like to have a session, please go on our hotline, 888-881-0881, and when it comes up with her name, punch it in, and she would love to speak to you. So, Anastasia, I'd like to thank you for part two.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. And we'll do another segment next week. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Back to you, Ariel.
Well, thank you so much, Anastasia. We can't wait to hear what's coming next week. And now we have our featured guest, Sheila Keen Lund, and we are going to bring her on the air right now. Hello, Sheila. Welcome.
Hello, Ariel and Lavender and Sierra. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Okay, this is Lavendar, and Sheila, I'm just very excited about you being on our show tonight. You and I had a brief talk yesterday about star markings and the work that we're doing here on Starseed Hotline. And I just wanted to let the audience know that years ago, I bought the Arantia book, And it was part of something that I would refer to often, and some of the high strangeness that I was going through in my life. So, Sheila, this book that you've written, Heaven is Not the Last Stop, you know, what sets this book apart from the other books that are out there in the spiritual genre?
Well, Lavender, what I think that it sets it apart from all others is that it presents a new and complete, an uncomprehensive worldview that is based on the planetary revelation that we talked about, the Urantia book. And because I've reconciled this advanced philosophy with current world belief systems, what I believe happens is that readers are able to discern new meanings in what they already know. And that is what progress is about discovering new meanings. So this is what I really feel sets apart the book. It's the fact that it does have this advanced philosophy presented from a planetary revelation.
What do you mean by planetary revelation?
Okay, that's a good question. So planetary revelation, I would say it's a gift to humankind that expands awareness of our origin, history, and destiny. And this is important because when we're able to do this, it reduces confusion, restores important bits of lost knowledge. It also fills in vital gaps in our knowledge. And this is one thing that I found the Urantia book did for me when I started to explore, is that I realized that I had lots of bits of information, but they seemed to be kind of floating on their own. And as I read the Urantia book and I started exploring it in relation to existing systems, it started to create a much more complete perspective. And this is, I think, what the revelation does for us. It provides to humanity this an advanced philosophy to be able to uplift the existing ones.
You know, you say that celestial or superhuman beings imparted the latest planetary revelation. Can you tell us more about that and how that you've discovered that?
Okay. One of the big things that I find I kind of discovered as I was going through this process is that our we need to start, I guess, rethinking what we think the universe is. Well, at least I know that that's what I had to do as I was going through this process. And so if we consider that the universe is vast, that is much more than the physical universe that we can see. Because, in fact, when you think that science, you know, with a huge universe that is continuously discovering, it's only just 4% of the universe. You know, the other 96% is made up of stuff that astronomers can't even see or detect or understand. So the universe is made up of both seen and unseen, the physical and the semi-spiritual and the spiritual. And so it's also just as our worlds are organized, so is the whole universe organized. Evolution is not something that is random. It's always guided. And so when the humans, which are evolving, get to a time when they need new information to dispel confusion or to take them to another level of understanding and awareness, information is giving. And so these beings that we may call celestial, this is what we've been calling them, we could call them superhumans, we have different names in this unseen part which are guiding our evolution, they, when the time is right, they provide information. And that needs to be separated from, you know, we're used to talking about personal revelations. You know, we get our own personal revelations all the time, whether we study or through visions. But these particular planetary revelations are given by these, what we may call them, superhumans or celestial beings, as a way to start a new era of evolution or understanding. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. What can you tell us about life on other planets as you've discovered through the Urantia material?
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, the Urantia tells us that the universe is huge, you know, that we have this what they call super universe. Other people call them galaxies, but they call them super universe, which are kind of rotating as a group around a central point. And this central point, we can call it, let's say, the central universe. And most of these galaxies or super universe are inhabited. But in the inhabited ones, there are sorts of different beings. Like, for instance, and this is really fascinating when you think of it, you know, it tells us that, for instance, that depending on the size of the planet, for instance, and the gravity, humans can be between 2 feet and 9 feet tall. Another thing they tell us is that the humanoids, they could, in some of the worlds, they are aquatic, whilst others have are able to fly. That's kind of weird thinking, but that's what they tell us. And in those planets that have atmosphere, you know, we tend to think that they cannot be live unless they have the same atmosphere as we do. And Urantia tells us now that there's planets where there are people who are called non-breathers. Like if there's no air, like the moon, if there was a planet with no air like that. And then there are others who are called like super breathers, and that's and then also meat breathers. Well, actually, we are meat breathers. And then they have the ones when the air is very thin. So that's interesting too. And actually, it tells us also, which I find is fascinating, it tells us that there is a non-breather planet in our own solar system, and that we will discover that one day. Wouldn't that be exciting to discover it in our lifetime?
I bet it's Mars. You know, wouldn't surprise me. You know, I remembered reading those two phrases that come to me, the thought adjusters and the midway creatures. And I always had such a good time just saying those two things. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes, the thought adjuster. The thought adjuster was fascinating for me because when you think of the different religions, the Indians, the Hindus, for instance, will talk about the Atman, and then you have, the divine spark. There's many, many names that different belief systems use for that spark of the divine within every human being, human personality. And to me, that was when I discovered that and reconciled it with my understanding, it really brought that a closeness to God which I had never experienced before. And so this spark of the divine is what in the book they call the thought adjuster, and it is the part of ourselves that is immortal. Now the midwares are fascinating creatures, which according to the Urantia book, every planet has, every inhabited planet has. And they are creatures which are, actually they call them the permanent citizens of a planet. And they call them our cousins. And basically they're the helpers of the angels. They're able to manipulate the material sphere. They can do what the angels cannot do. So they're the great helpers. And so this to me was fascinating also, because, when you think in the different studies and research that I have done, you hear about maybe somebody's drowning and they see somebody helping them and then the person disappears. And so who knows, maybe it was a midword. That's what what I believe it is. And so they're fascinating creatures.
Are you
continuously
saying
helping
meat,
us, by the way.
I'm not sure what you're saying. They're meat wares. What did you call them?
Meat wares. Meat wares.
Spell that.
M-I-D-W-A-Y-E-R-S.
I get it. Okay, I kept thinking you were saying meat, and I thought, what?
That's my Spanish accent.
I'm sorry. Okay, we're back on track now. Okay.
Meat wares.
How about this book that was published in 1955? Why the delay in releasing this book? Can you give us some information about that?
Yeah. Well, the Urantia book was it was in the making for many, many years, many decades. But I personally believe that they couldn't give it out before for various reasons. For example, you know, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls was not until the 40s, and the Sumerian tablets weren't discovered until the end of the 19th century, I believe, and weren't really translated for many years after. And they talk a lot about a Sumerian civilization. And the other thing, and then so it was impossible. I mean, how could they reveal something that the humans themselves had no knowledge about? So I think that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that they talked about a universe that at the time, in the middle of the beginning of the 20th century, we thought was much smaller than we know now it is. And so it had to wait until the discovery of the Hubble, you know, Hubble to be around and discover the universe was huge, so that then people would be able to start getting information and reconciling it. So I believe that's why the delay is. It's not published that's what the delay is, but that's what I really believe is one of the reasons maybe why they delayed the publishing.
Well, I can kind of understand that, because when I was given the material that I was given and they told me to put it in a bank vault and hold it for 30 years, I understand better now than I did at the time. So sometimes we can get information and just have to put it away until the consciousness is ready to receive it on the planet, or until other things line up to give it more credibility. So Yeah.
And I remember when I was writing the book, I kept, you know, in my own personal prayers, I kept saying, you know, there has to be a reason why this happened. And it was during the middle of the night that I got up with these thoughts and I wrote them down. So I really think that it was that, because imagine if you don't even know anything about, you know, like in those days, they didn't know anything about Sumerians, and then all of a sudden you read a book that has so much information about them. It wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the ancient texts, they mention the gods who came down to earth to create a hybrid race. Explain how heaven is not the last stop brings new insights into such myths and legends.
Well, you know, when I started writing the book, I mentioned to you earlier that I wanted to disprove. I wanted to disprove what it said, and so I started doing a lot of research into, you know, the ancient texts, and one of the things that I found it was fascinating that when I read their stories, it sounded so very much alike as to what the Urantia book said happened, you know, 500,000 years and 37,000 years ago, when beings came down with visitors. I wouldn't say visitors, but volunteers from other planets to start civilization. And so imagine when you think that in those days, you know, 500,000 years ago, beings coming down and meeting the creatures, you know, the primitive people at the time, and then befriending them, how they must have seen these beings, you know, who they must have thought they were. And so, you know, I believe that the combat myths and the mythologies that we have their origin there, and that information was passed on from generation to generation. And because some of that volunteer staff that came down to help humanity, some of it, you know, there was this, what they call the planetary rebellion, where there was a break between half of the staff, and that about that is written a lot of the combat myths, which you hear them from all parts of the world, and so that to me is fascinating, because I realize that there is an origin to all these methodologies that we have. Does that make sense?
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Lucifer Rebellion?
Okay, the Lucifer Rebellion, if you consider that our universe is, how can I say, that evolution is guided, and our universe has beings that that guide, obviously, the evolution of the planet. And Lucifer was, was this what you would call maybe the leader, just by using these terms, maybe the leader or the one that was overseeing our local system. And Satan was his first lieutenant, and he communicated with a being called Kaliskasia, which people tend to refer to here as Satan. And so there was Lucifer at the time was trying to break from the universe government, and was trying to get, in fact, it got 37 planets from the local system to rebel against the universe government. And so there was this big, they put the planet in quarantine, spiritual quarantine. And so that's the planetary rebellion of 200,000 years ago. And so, yeah, that's what they call the planetary rebellion. And that was a time when you know, this stuff that I told you came down from what we called Jerusalem. They volunteered to come down here to help humanity. Some of them became rebellious. They joined the rebellion, and they were the ones that perhaps, you know, in the, I don't know if you are familiar with the Bible, they talk about the sons of God who went and with the females of the area, and they talk about these giants, and they're the ones also that in, for instance, the Sumerian texts, they talk about the Anunnaki, and let me see, I think in others, they call them as the Watchers. So they have different names for these beings that came down and then mated with the women around and created what some people think is a hybrid race. It sounds very like Star Trek or something.
Yeah, but it's very true. And I have to tell you that our audience knows and believes and this and much more. So there's nothing you can really say to shock our audience. We have a pretty hep audience that tunes in on Tuesdays to listen.
That is great. That is really reassuring, because sometimes, you know, when I'm talking, I feel as if I'm, especially if I'm trying to explain something to sort of, I don't know if you call them regular people, but when you try to explain it to people, is I try to use my words in ways that to make it more realistic, but it's very hard to make it sound realistic.
Yeah, well, visualize this. Everybody that listens to our radio show, they're practically sitting on the Enterprise and sitting up in Star Trek.
That's great. That's very reassuring.
Okay, let me ask you. I know there's been a lot of recent scientific discoveries, and have they validated some of the information that you present in your book?
Well, yes. I one of the things that I wanted to do when I was writing Heaven is Not the Last Stop is because, I was trying to disprove it. So every time it came up with something, I would say, okay, well, let me see if I can find something in the internet, obviously, to try, or some archaeological discovery. And for instance, one of the things that I discovered was that, you know, they have the out of Africa theory that we came out of Africa, the humans came out from there. But now there's a lot of archaeological findings in Americas and in India that are beginning to conflict with that. And so that to me was very, very interesting. The other thing was that, you know, the beings that uplift humanity, which in some cultures are called Adam and Eve, came down about 37,000 years ago. And what I found really interesting was that there was a group of scientists, I believe it was, I'm not sure in what state, but they found that there were two genes that were involved in brain evolution, and that there was a variation that occurred about 37,000 years ago. So that I found really interesting, and that's just a few of the things. There's a lot, and I tried to go through every chapter, and I tried to bring that which I have discovered in this respect.
How has your family been able to understand what you've been doing with this book? Are they supportive of your work, or do they just raise their eyebrow?
I mean, they raise their eyebrow. They're very supportive. They're definitely supportive. They don't say anything. You know, they are definitely supportive of me, but they raise their eyebrows. You know, they are very strong. My sisters are, two of them are very strong Christians and Catholics at that. And my father just puts a question mark on everything. And, you know, ever since I was little, you know, I mean, I've also had experiences where I would see, it was interesting because I saw Anastasia talking about an Indian running? And I had an experience when I was in my early 20s where I was in the house, and all of a sudden I went into a room and I kind of like I stumbled over what looked like a big carrying bag, like a picnic bag or like a little suitcase, but it was a bag. And I thought, that's weird, because there was nothing there. And all of a sudden I saw this man standing there just for a short while, like leaning against something and with this bag, and then he disappeared. And that was very shocking to me. And of course, when I told my parents, they told me I was imagining it. So I've had those experiences, but you know, again, they're supportive. They're supportive of me, even though they may not believe.
It's my understanding that you had two near-death experiences. Can you relate some of that information to us?
Yes. When I was little, when I was about 7 years old, I went swimming with my father, and he was entertaining some officers from a warship. He worked with for a cable company. And I went in the water with two of these officers, and they were holding my hands. And then all of a sudden, they let go my hands, and when I looked forward, there was this huge wave that just carried me under the water. And what I remember from that experience was that I could see myself rolling in the water, but I was just looking at myself. I was looking at this little girl rolling, and I was very calm, and that calmness remained all the time. Every time I kept thinking of that experience, all I could remember was that calmness. There was no, you know, no fear or anything. And I came to in the sand with people around me. So that was one. And I don't know how long I had been lying down there. I just remember I woke up and I had all these people looking at me. And then the second experience, I was in the dentist chair and they gave me nitrous oxide, and I must have had a reaction to it or something. But I felt myself being pulled out from the top of my head, and I was in this little train, and I was moving towards this tunnel, which seemed to be too small for me. And then I remember I was trying to get into the tunnel, but I heard my grandfather's voice, who was dead at the time, and his voice took my attention from the tunnel, and he just told me that I needed to go back, that it wasn't my time. And I woke up in the dentist chair, and everybody was all, you know, working on me, etc. And being a young girl and being a Catholic at the time, I would explain this to my teachers and to my parents, and they all told me it was a dream. You know, but I always, those two experiences, having had them, always led me to explore. I just wanted to find answers.
You know, when I went to the dentist some years ago and had that Noxide, I saw up on a screen Crack Between the Worlds, and that's when I decided what I was going to name the story that came out of the vault. It came out of a dentist chair.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's quite something, you know, and it's interesting because what I found, and I don't know if you had that experience, but sometimes you say you talk to people trying to better understand your experiences, but people tend to either diminish them or ignore them as if, you know, it was one's imagination. But I always kept saying, you know, when you have an experience that is so real and you never forget it, it's definitely not a dream.
Right, right. Yeah. What would you say are the two most urgently revealed concepts from your book, Heaven is Not the Last Stop?
The two most urgently. Well, I would say, let's see, if I was talking from the perspective of Christians or I would say that the most important is the discovery of the true teachings of Jesus, that his true gospel, his life, because the one in the Bible is not very complete or accurate, and the one that's presented in the Revelation, which I bring about in my book, Heaven is Not the Last Stop, is so inspiring. I mean, at the time, even though I was a Catholic, Jesus really meant nothing to me. You know, he was just somebody that I heard about in church. But it just took on new meaning, and I obtained a new respect and love for Jesus just through learning more complete his true life and teaching. So that would be one of the things. And I think also an amazing point, which I think is so important that we gather, is that our universe is, we have this huge, humongous universe, spiritual universe, that is supporting the physical one, and that we need to start looking at our world, starting our life, starting and continuing through this multi-level universe, continuously growing and developing and growing in perfection. So that would be, and then if I was looking at it from the perspective of science, I would say, my God, the Urantia book presents so, you know, a humongous representation of the universe, which science still has to discover, and also it presents the chapter that fascinates me is the one on the global migration, and we have so much to learn from that, so much that we can start exploring from that. So, I think from those two different perspectives, those are the points.
Okay. When Jesus spoke of the kingdom of heaven, what do you think he was referring to?
Okay. Jesus had spoken in the kingdom of in this world, and then the from two perspectives. And I think when he spoke of one, the my Father's kingdom, I think he meant the one that we go when we die, you know, when we live and we move into the sphere which we call heaven, which is really that part of the unseen part of the universe. And then when he talks about the kingdom in this world, he refers to the brotherhood of man. He refers to the brotherhood of man that needs to come about by people growing in God-likeness, growing in the understanding that we're all brothers and sisters, and that is the kingdom in this world.
If heaven is not the last stop, what is? That's one of the questions that you sent me to ask you, and so I'm really anxious to hear what you have to say to this.
Well, you know, this is really interesting because, you know, if you think that growth is continuous, right? And remember I mentioned before that we have these super universes revolving around the central universe, which is the place where we're all moving towards. Okay, well, if you think of that perspective, one of the things that we're told also is that there are huge uninhabited parts of the universe which are really on the outside. They call them, I can't remember exactly how they call them, I'm not very good at the astronomy part, but that they're outside. And what I believe happens, and they only have told us glimpses, is that as people continue to evolve and they reach the perfection of spirit, we may have the opportunity to go and populate those uninhabited and yet undeveloped parts of the universe. And that is really exciting. I mean, it's like what the angels and the archangels and did for our universe, we will be doing in other galaxies. And so that's very exciting.
I noticed that you also, in your book, you go into great detail about Egypt and Crete and Greece. Is this part of the Urantia material, or is this research that you did on your own?
No, that's research. That's research, because what happens is, you know, you can read a book, and it really does not have a lot of meaning unless you can relate it to existing knowledge. And so what I, when I did the Urantia book, when I wrote my book, Heaven is Not the Last Stop, what I did is I took this revelation, and in trying to disprove it, I tried to, I read everything that I could find, and I researched, and I would research, and I would write to people. And one of the things that I did is I tried to make sure that all the information I got was the most original. So, you know, it wasn't just somebody had said, you know, but that it came from. So I bring information just as I research it from all parts of the world, all types of religions, all types of things that I could find that would help enliven this philosophy to the readers.
Well, I notice in this book that you take science, metaphysics, you take the Bible, you take history, and you weave such a wonderful pattern from the total creation of the solar system to the creation of planet Earth, its establishment, its biological evolution, the human species, the evolution of races and religions. This is so detailed. I mean, the detail is just mind-boggling what you must have gone through to put this together.
It took 13 years. The thing about it is that when I started writing this book, one of the things that I wanted, and I really had a big, strong intention, was I didn't want it to be my opinion or my thoughts or my beliefs. I wanted to be accurate. I wanted to make sure that what I was writing, I wasn't misleading. And so what happened was that sometimes, you know, it's very easy to let go of beliefs that you're ready to let go. It's not easy when you're not ready. And so many times during my research, I would have to just explore, just read and read, and I couldn't move forward in a particular chapter, for instance. And I had to go detail by detail. I mean, I did not know the name of the chapter before I started writing the chapter. It was just a process of moving forward, of continuous exploration, research, reflection, frustration, and then I would. But it was exhilarating because all of a sudden, you know, when I saw the civilizations in Egypt, and then I read of in Greeks all the different archaeological findings and things. Took on new meaning and such excitement and passion and it also gave me this amazing sense of humility and gratitude for the opportunities we have to grow in this wisdom. And so it was an amazing experience, which I hope the readers can capture. And I have study groups. I do study groups and I do some workshops and I tell the people, you know, in the group that, you know, knowledge, you can obtain knowledge and you have this level of recognition, but then, you know, you need to go through the level of realization and to the level of appreciation so that it really resonates on an emotional level. And that takes time. That takes the desire to, you know, discover new meanings and then experiencing that understanding at the most profound level of your being, and it's exciting. It was exciting for me, and I hope that, you know, that as readers go through that process, they can experience that too.
When you came up with the title, Heaven is Not the Last Stop, was that Did you see that that come as a vision, or how did you arrive at that title?
That was really an experience. I'll tell you. I was at the time when I started, before I started writing, I was a deaconess in a liberal Catholic church, and I was teaching workshops on how to care for those who were dying, and I was using Buddhist techniques, and the people that I was giving the workshops to, they would tell me, you know, you need to write a book and things like that, and I would say, you know, I have nothing to say, I have you know, nothing new to add to what has been written, but I started having these thoughts of writing a book, and it would come in different ways. So one day, as I was going to the airport, I was kind of fed up of having this thought, write a book. So I decided to have this conversation, and I said, you know, God, if you want me to write a book, then I want the name, and I want also a sign, and I want something that I can, you know, something that is, I don't have to figure out, something very straightforward. And so I said, let that sign be that one of my children talk to me about life after death, because I thought that's what my book would be like. I mean, that's what I was teaching. So anyway, and I said, and remember the name, because I can't come up with any. So as it was, a couple of weeks later, one of my sons came, and we started watching a movie. And soon after that, he says, Mom, do you believe in life after death? So that was, you know, that got me off my chair quickly. and the name came a couple of weeks later. I was in my office, and I picked up a book, and I just had this thought, I wonder what the name of my book is going to be. And I heard, on the right side of my ear, I heard, Heaven is Not the Last Stop. And I was so shocked, because it was 5 o'clock in the morning, I was alone in my office, and I dropped my book, and I forgot the name, and I said, what was that? And I heard again, Heaven is Not the Last Stop. So that's how that book came about. That's how the name came about.
Oh, I love that. That's, you know, we call that synchronization is confirmation. And with that, I would like to end my part of the interview, and I'd like to turn it over now to Arielle and Sierra to see if they have any questions, and to open up the switchboard so that people that want to call in can talk to you. If you've read the Urantia book, or if you have questions about the Urantia book, something that's dear to your heart, please call in and talk to our guest tonight. So back to you, Arielle.
Okay, and if you do want to come on the air or ask a question to Sheila, you need to press 1 so that we know that you want to come on the air. And we do have a caller. Let's take this call first, and then we will go to you, Sierra. So heads up, we are going to talk to Ralph. Hello, Ralph.
Hello, good evening. Just a wonderful show. Lovely guests. Sheila, I was just wondering, in your, you said you were Catholic and coming up, and you had some revelations about a change of a belief about Jesus or Yeshua, however one want to refer to him. And then you gained a different perspective on him and started to appreciate him. Do you believe that he himself has already reincarnated?
That say that again, that Jesus reincarnated?
Yes.
Is that the question? Did Jesus reincarnate?
Yes, has he?
Right.
Do you believe he has reincarnated?
Okay, so what I understand from the Urantia book, which made sense. Remember that I mentioned that the universe is, everything is guided, and that there is guidance. So the being that created the universe, the local universe, I'm not talking about the huge, is incarnated as the person of Jesus. So I would say that Jesus is both divine and human, and that he incarnated into the person of Jesus to reveal the personality of God to humanity. Does that answer your question? I don't believe
I think
you're...
What, Yeah, I think what Ralph was getting at is that has Jesus visited us again in more recent times through an incarnation? And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Lavendar, isn't there information out there that a man called Sananda was carrying that soul?
Yes, the one that we knew of is Jesus had no reason to incarnate again. He was a very high being that dwells and functions from other levels, and will not take on the earth, flesh, human, karmic pattern of any kind. Yeah. He has no need to.
Right. And he did say, in the Urantia book tells us that he'll come here at some point, but when he came, he came at a time when the world wasn't even ready for him. He came a whole dispensation before. So we have a lot of work to do before, if ever, he just decides to come here again. So I agree with you.
So, Ralph, does that answer your question?
Well, somewhat. Just... not really.
Go ahead. What makes you think that?
I just get conflicting information about that particular being, and whether he's come back.
Like in the Bible, like.
No.
No.
From various sources, people who claim that he has come back and reincarnated in the person of, for instance, Lord Sananda, living in India, I believe, and so forth. Not came back to continue what was said that he did in the Bible, but I was just wondering if you believe that was his destiny to reincarnate again. But I got it, and I appreciate your position on that, and thank you very much. You're very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. It's great to hear from you. So we do have another question. And we are going to go next to Kat. Sorry, Sierra, we'll be, you're coming up next. So, Kat, you have a question for Sheila?
I had a question about the role that the Elohim would be playing. There's a lot of talk about the Elohim coming back with Kamen Elin, and I was just curious whether or not if that's true, or because I kind of feel like they're already here.
I'm not understanding who you're talking about.
The return of the nine gods, the Elohim.
Oh, the Elohim. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because the Urantia book talks a little bit about the Elohim, and but I'm not. I don't think it talks about it from the perspective maybe that you're talking about it. So I don't want to. Yeah, it basically describes how they talk about it in terms of how the three in one, and that's in the terms that they use it, but not, I don't think, in the terms that you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Because I'm just thinking from like the Mayans and the Hopi and a bunch of others are referring to the return of the nine gods, and I just kind of feel like they're already here. That's just when they're going to be come out. You know what I mean?
I would not know. You know, one of the things that I have found for myself that I have, because there is so much that one can get involved with here is that, and this is something which I think I also got from reading. Writing this book was that my job was to focus on developing myself to the best that I could, so that I could be of the best use to humanity. And I think that if I focus on that, then whatever happens, whoever comes, I'm doing the best that I can for the world right now. And hopefully, I can keep on track doing that. So otherwise, it can get very confusing with so much that has been written about so many things.
Exactly. But I do thank mm-hmm. you for your book yes. and your help, because it's like seeds. It's little seeds that we planted from lifetimes ago, and it's just tracing those seeds back. And
exactly, yes.
People like you and that come out and put these books out and help us remember the things that we need to remember so we can take on the whole ascension and the whole awakening process, and that's what's important.
Yes.
So I do
well,
really appreciate
you.
The information that you put out there, and I know there's way too much out there. It's way too confusing. And so many of us are like, is it this way or is it that way, or you know what I mean? So
yes,
as long as
yeah.
you can stay on track and know that you know what you know and
mm-hmm.
stick by it, that's a beautiful
yes.
thing. So I really appreciate
yeah, thank
that.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Blessings.
Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to go to Sierra next, our other co-host. Hello, Sierra.
Hello, ladies. How are you all?
Hello.
We're just doing fine.
it's been such a joy to listen to you, Sheila. It's just you're
thank
a
you.
Woman after my own heart, and the process, your description that you just said a few minutes ago about your process, and
mm-hmm.
writing the book, and that you'd
yes.
hope that would translate to people who are actually reading the book, has just actually helped me out so much. I'm actually currently
mm-hmm.
writing my own book, and it
mm-hmm.
is, you just captured the experience of that. So thank you
oh,
for
wow.
saying that.
Oh,
it's just
you.
Really beautiful. So,
mm-hmm.
and I just so appreciate this. I'm actually going to get your book and read it, and I think that...
Oh,
thank
you.
All the information that you've brought forward to us and our listeners are just, it's just spot on. And for me, it makes a good leap, because my, family and friends who are Southern Baptist have a hard time getting past that heaven conversation.
I know.
And,
yeah.
and myself being an Episcopalian minister, have attempted to, probably more so in the last 5 years with my ongoing contact, to... put that into words for people. So I'm going to pick up your book, I'm going to read it, and I think it's going to give me some tools and to have the kind of conversations with those, particular people. Because, our wonderful star seeds, they're there already, and they don't need to be enlightened to, pass the conversation of,
mm-hmm.
What's after heaven. But the people that mean a lot to me, my
mm-hmm.
family, I sure would love to have a few more tools to have that conversation. So thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really,
yes. Thank
really,
you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Back to you, Ariel.
Okay. Sierra, thank you. Well, if we have a lot of callers on the switchboard, and if you have a question, you have to press 1 so that we know you have something to say. And pending anyone's question, I don't see any coming up right now. So, Lavendar, do you have any further insights on this subject?
Well, yes. Well, Sheila, give your website so people can look at your website. What is your website?
Okay, my website is www.heavenisnotthelaststop.com. The book can be, you can always go there, and you can get it in Amazon also. And it's available in both hardcover and also in Kindle. And we're working on having it put for the Apple, which is still maybe within the next week or so. And with this, the Spanish and French translations will be coming towards the end of the year.
Okay, great.
Excellent.
Well, if we don't have any more questions, if no one wants to call in and can help us continue this, then maybe we should just end early tonight.
Okay.
Okay, well, just as you said that, we have another question. Well, we have our dear sister from Cripple Creek on the line. So let's just talk to Belva here for a second. Hang on a second, Belva. I'm trying to get your mic open. There you go. Hello, Belva.
Here I am.
Hello.
I really am enjoying your talk, and I wanted you to say your www address again.
It is www.heavenisnotthelaststop.com.
Oh, okay. That's good. I've had a lot of past life recall, and a lot of the things you talked about I've been involved in, so it was very, very interesting to me.
I'm so glad. Yeah, Belva, you're really breaking up, and we're having a hard time.
I know, yeah. It's breaking up for me, too.
Okay. Well, we're so glad that you called in, and I know that that you're going to pick up the book as well. And I know, like you said, Belva has a lot of past life recall, so it's going to put a lot of pieces together for her, I'm sure. But, Belva, I'm going to have to put you back on mute because it's breaking up. I can hardly hear what you're saying.
All right.
Okay.
Hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, we will be back next week with part three of High Strangeness with Anastasia. We want to thank our guest, Sheila Keen Lund, author of Heaven is Not the Last Stop, and the website, again, heavenisnotthelaststop.com. I want to thank everyone for joining us this week, and we'll be back next week, Tuesday at 7 o'clock. Sheila Keen Lund, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you to those listening.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.